Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. With offices in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Just before we get going here, Mike Solis just handed me some weather information I want to pass on to you. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a flash flood warning for Macon County in central Illinois. That will be in effect until 1 this afternoon. At 10 o'clock this morning, local law enforcement officials reported thunderstorms with very heavy rainfall across the warned area. And some of the locations that could well experience flooding include places like Decatur and Argenta, Blue Mound, Forsyth, Harristown, Long Creek, Macon, Moroa, Mount Zion, Nyantic, Oriana, and Warrensburg. Flooding is imminent or occurring. If you're in this warned area, do move to higher ground right away. People who live along streams and creeks should take immediate precautions to protect life and property, and particularly do not try to cross swiftly flowing waters or waters of unknown depth by foot or in some kind of vehicle. That's the way a lot of people get into trouble in a flash flood situation. So again, this is a flash flood warning. It's for Macon County in central Illinois until 1 o'clock this afternoon. And we are expecting some heavy rain to continue here this morning, and I guess a chance of more rain developing this afternoon. So we will keep you posted about what's going on in the weather. You just keep it tuned here to AM 580. Well, this is Focus 580, the first hour of the program. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour, we'll be talking with a journalist who spent a lot of time covering the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. His name is Misha Glenny. He was at one time Central Europe correspondent for the BBC World Service. He won a Sony Award for his coverage of the conflict in Yugoslavia and has written two books, The Fall of Yugoslavia, published in 1992, and The Balkans, published in 1999. He's currently working as a political consultant on Southeastern Europe and spends his time still there in that part of the world and also in Britain, in London, where he lives. And he's working actually now on another big major reporting project about organized crime in the new global economy. Maybe one day we'll talk about that.
I hope so.
When that is out. That's actually the subject of a talk that he will be giving this evening on the U of I campus. This is in the MillerCom series. The title is The Spider Trap, Corruption, Organized Crime, and Transition in the Balkans and Russia. That'll be this evening at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus on the third floor. Of course, all these programs are always free and open to the public. Anyone interested in attending should feel welcome. Also here on this program, questions are welcome. The number 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people who are listening are welcome to call with questions. The only thing we ask is that people just try to be brief so that we can get in as many callers as possible. But anyone who would like to call should feel welcome. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, you're welcome. It's nice to be here.
There are a number of things that I thought we could do, including trying to review the Balkan Wars, mm-hmm. for those people who either have forgotten what they were about or never really could understand. And I think probably there are a lot of people who would say, I never really did understand. But just to pick up something that was in the news recently, I thought we might start by talking about the death of Slobodan Milosevic. He was on trial for war crimes in The Hague. This trial had been going on for 4 years. And on the 11th of March, he died. Do you think that the fact that he died before there could be some kind of closure, at least in the legal sense, matters very much? Or was the fact that he was there at all, is that important enough so that it doesn't matter that there was no judgment finally?
I think the fact that he was there was important. It was certainly very significant politically. And obviously those people, and there are many of them who suffered at his hands, may well feel aggrieved that he escaped justice by death. However, I personally have the feeling that, he's dead, and that's really where he belongs. I don't mourn his passing for one minute, and he created an immense amount of suffering throughout southeastern Europe. And I'm glad he's dead in the sense that politically the region will find it now easier to move on and move forward. But of course, the trial at The Hague, his trial at The Hague and the whole Hague process with regard to southeastern Europe, and increasingly we're seeing in one or two other parts in the world, Rwanda and now most recently Liberia with the Charles Taylor arrest, is a very profound issue about how international relations will move forward in terms of conflict, in terms of the relationship between the West and less stable areas, and how you manage conflicts and post-conflict situations. And I don't think that the Milosevic trial answered all of the many questions that that this subject raises. For example, there was a lot of criticism of the Hague and the chief prosecutor, Carlo Del Ponte, for having brought too many charges and too cumbersome a case against Milosevic, so that it took so long, even though it had been established a long time ago, long before he was arrested, while he was still in power, that his health was never very good, and that instead they should have brought cases more like the ones being brought against Saddam Hussein at the moment, which are sort of iconic cases that can be processed swiftly so that a verdict can be arrived at before something like this happens.
I think one of the questions that have been raised is even if the trial had proceeded and gone all the way to a conclusion, would he have been convicted or not?
Well, we don't know. I mean, you know, he enjoyed, I think, the trial once he'd reconciled himself to being in The Hague, and I think that took quite a long time. He always enjoyed a stage, and he liked playing games. And in a strange sort of way, he was able to turn The Hague, the courtroom, into a board game where he was sort of, you know, jostling with various characters, with Carla Del Ponte, with her deputies, with the judges, with the witnesses. And he did turn it into a rather theatrical event. Some people were suggesting that there was not going to be a conviction. Mm-hmm. But that, I think, leads to unnecessary and inaccurate conspiracy theories about him being got rid of because there was no conviction coming. And I think that's, if you'll excuse the language, absolute twaddle.
Well, this there was all sorts of wild and maybe some not-so-wild speculation about the circumstances of his death. I'm sure that there were people in Serbia who felt that he was murdered. And there was a lot of complaint, I think, among Serbs because they felt that perhaps his medical treatment that he was receiving was inadequate. And he himself had asked to go to Russia to have treatment. And I think that the people there in The Hague said, no, we think our doctors are just fine. And there was some question about whether, in fact, he had done something, had taken some unprescribed medication in an effort to appear more sick than he was, so that would add weight to his argument that he should be allowed to go to Russia for medical treatment, and that perhaps, in fact, that he killed him, in a sense, he killed himself by...
Yes, I think you're extrapolating too much here. Obviously, this debate has been going on. I don't think in some senses it's that serious. However, what is serious is that The Hague undoubtedly has egg on its face for not letting him go to Russia. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem that The Hague would argue about that is that Russia's support for the processes of The Hague Tribunal have been ambiguous at best in the past. And we also know that Milosevic's wife and son were domiciled in Moscow, and that there was a genuine fear that he might not return should he go to Moscow. Having said that, I think, you know, his health record had been bad for a very long time. It was common knowledge that he was diabetic, that he had heart problems in the early 1990s, and so maybe the Hague Tribunal should have paid more attention to that aspect of his incarceration.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Misha Glenny. During the Yugoslav crisis of the early 90s, he was the Central Europe correspondent for the BBC World Service and won a lot of recognition for his work covering that conflict. He's authored two books, one of them, The Fall of Yugoslavia, published in 1992, and The Balkans, published in 1999. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think now looking back, that, as I said at the beginning, I think that there are a lot of people who never really did understand what this was about, in spite of the fact that it got considerable coverage. National Public Radio covered it. The BBC covered it. So people certainly heard a lot of it on our air. And I do, in fact, remember hearing people say, why are you spending so much time with this? Even when it was going on, I think people thought, well, why does this matter? If we can, and I realize you've written a couple of books on this, I mean, but if we can give the thumbnail sketch about exactly what this was about, how does one explain it?
I mean, it's important. The issue about why we were spending so much time on this is an important one, because at the same time, there were many more deaths occurring in Sudan, for example, which was in the grip of a very vicious civil war. This is pre-Darfur. This was southern Sudan. And that received scant attention. If you look at the Democratic Republic of Congo over the past 5-6 years or so, where 3 to 4 million people have been killed, I mean, these are figures which are way out of proportion of the numbers who died in the former Yugoslavia, but it's the Democratic Republic of Congo, and so people don't apparently seem to care quite as much. And so it begs the question that you're asking, why was this so important? Now, there are elements to the Yugoslav conflict that are very important. Why it happened is simply you had a country with many different national identities in it, which was essentially in its second form, that is, from the Second World War, sustained by the Cold War. It was neither on one side nor the other. It was a one-party dictatorship, and in fact, for many years, very much a one-person dictatorship, Marshal Tito's dictatorship. And that construct, when communism began to crumble in Eastern Europe, and when the raison d'etre for Yugoslavia politically was no longer there, at a time when the country had racked up huge debts with the West and was economically extremely weak and its infrastructure was crumbling, creating all sorts of social tensions, combined with those problems of ethnic identity, meant that it was the one country in the sort of main, one of the one main country in Europe which couldn't sustain those pressures. And then you had the active elements of Slobodan Milosevic in particular, and also Franjo Tudjman, the Croatian president, who were seeking territorial aggrandizement at the expense of other nationalities, and who had access to considerable weaponry and money to play out their games. And so that's essentially what you had. Once it destabilizes, you throw up all sorts of secondary issues of ethnic conflict and constitutional viability and so on and so forth. This happened in the middle of Europe. And because Europe is one of the powerhouses of the global economy and the powerhouses of global political life, if you have something in the middle of Europe, then it really does impact on things which affect all sorts of people around the world in an immediate sense. Now, that, I suspect, is why the Yugoslavia received proportionally much more coverage than other conflicts around the world. There was also a danger of it spreading to other parts of Europe. But it still does raise the issue, you know, does this conflict receive more coverage than, say, the Democratic Republic of Congo because it's white people involved as opposed to black people involved?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that question is an important one, obviously. I think at the same time, people who spend their time studying modern Europe, you know, Europe after 1900, I suppose, would argue that two world wars were fought in an effort to achieve some kind of stability in that part of the world, and that this conflict, should it get out of hand, could indeed have threatened that stability. I mean, after all, that's how World War I started.
Yeah, the difference, of course, between Yugoslavia in the 1990s and 1914 and 1941, which is when it really got going in the Balkans in the Second World War, mm-hmm. is that this was essentially restricted to southeastern Europe and to the former Yugoslavia in particular. It wasn't so much a Balkan war, it was a war of the former Yugoslavia. Mm. Whereas in 1914 and in 1941, that region was, to my mind, and this is really what my book, the Balkans, is about, was the victim of external conflict between the great powers who were using this area as a sort of cat's paw for their own interests politically and strategically. And the violence, the bulk of the violence that has been visited upon southeastern Europe over the 20th century is, to my mind, unquestionably the consequence of external interference rather than the consequence of internal tensions.
One more point, and then I have a caller here that I want to get to. And that is, again, going back to what this conflict, the war in the former Yugoslavia, I suppose there were three of them, really, if you think about Croatia, Bosnia, and Kosovo.
There's also Slovenia as well. Let's throw it in the 10-day taster.
that goes to the idea that I think that many people had and maybe still have, and that's the ancient ethnic hatreds explanation, which a lot of people said, well, you know, these people, they've been fighting with each other forever. They hate each other. They're always going to fight. And what this enables you to do, if you're an outsider, it enables you to say, well, there's nothing anybody can do about this. If these people want to kill each other, they will, and we can't do anything about it. That, I think, is something that was in people's minds. And I think it's an important idea, and you certainly have touched on it, that what really was going on here was that it was a land grab of historic proportions and of a few individuals, notably Mr. Milosevic, who people will remember, and Franjo Tuđman, that has, I think, been his part in this has been kind of forgotten. He's been dead for a little while now.
Yeah.
That the two of them really are greatly responsible for a lot of the violence to follow. And simply, it was empire building. The former Yugoslavia was coming apart, and they wanted to put together as much of a little empire as they could, put together as much ground as they possibly could.
And they collaborated on it in the carving up of Bosnia. I mean, these two who were at once fighting with each other and collaborating in, you know, the rape of Bosnia. It's hideous, really. Yeah.
So it was really, and I think you've made this point yourself. I mean, it was about accumulation of power. It was about greed. It was...
And later on, it was about money as well. Yeah. I mean, what's first of all important is to trash the ancient hatreds argument. 5 minutes of historical scrutiny and you realize that this is all nonsense and this is the process of mythology building from all sorts of people. But once you get this thing going, and once also you have sanctions imposed on the former Yugoslavia, then they're spending an awful lot of money prosecuting this war. The people who are actually doing the fighting, the leaders of the fighting, are extremely unsavory characters. A lot of them organized crime figures. They start to use this war as a way of building up, it's what I'd call the primitive accumulation of capital, i.e. building up little sort of business empires out of war. And there were embargoes on them. And this devastated the surrounding region economically, and they started importing huge amounts of stuff to prosecute the war, Croatia, Bosnia and Serbia and the Albanians. And in order to do this, they had to sell stuff. Now, they couldn't sell conventional goods anymore because they weren't producing any. And so this is when the Balkans started to become a factory of organized crime, selling illicit goods and services, drugs, trafficking women, weapons, untaxed cigarettes into the European Union, where there was a huge market for this, and this fueled the war. The war was actually being financed by a pan-Balkan mafia, and you would have the perverse situation of the fighters and mafia traders on one side cooperating with the very people that they were fighting with. It was an extraordinary economic and social event because if it was of such large proportions. And the logic of this took over. They were making so much money out of it, they wanted the war to continue. It was horrific.
Yeah. And just one final point. Do you think that if Franjo Tuđman had lived long enough he would have been indicted as a war criminal?
I certainly hope so. I mean, if he hadn't, then there would have been no credibility in terms of the Milosevic trial, but also, you know, I mean, most of the majority of the indicted war criminals are, of course, Serbs. And Tudjman and one other Croatian character was certainly should have been top of the list. They both died. Had that not happened, then the Hague would have been very hard on credibility. They were looking into Tudjman, I know, because, I mean, apart from anything, they consulted me on it at an early stage.
We do have a caller here. Let's bring them in. Someone listening in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Good day. I think there's an argument to be made about great power in interference prior to the war beginning, the idea that for all of its flaws, Yugoslavia was a independent economic kind of model in some way with a lot of worker control, you know, maybe not terribly authentic, but that's another discussion. I'd rather continue what you were just talking about and the idea that the Serbs are seeing this as victor's justice. If Tudjman wouldn't have been brought to the dock, he also escaped by dying, apparently, but before he got to the dock. But we have this instance of Akim Ketu, who was with the KLA. Actually, he worked with Tudjman in Krajina prior to that. And I understand he is now, you know, the prime minister of Kosovo. The previous prime minister, whose name I don't know, had to resign because he was under some criminal proceedings. So, you know, why, you know, there's no reason why the Serbs can't spin a story of this is persecution, this is victor's justice, et cetera, et cetera. And they can even go further and say, look at Camp Bondsteel, you know, the biggest base in Kosovo, one of the biggest U.S. bases in and a most modern one in the world. And they can also say, well, you know, maybe this is what the war was really about, you know, a lily, not much more than a lily pad, as they're calling the new defense strategy of the U.S. as far as, you know, regional dynamics and control of, the world, as it were, and regional analysis.
Let me take those points one by one. First of all, Agim Ceku, who's now the Prime Minister of Kosovo, and Ramush Haradinaj, who's the one who's indicted and in The Hague and was Prime Minister when he was indicted. At least he was indicted as Prime Minister and he stopped having to be Prime Minister and he went to The Hague. They have, however, been notably more indulgent about Haradinaj's political activity than they were about any of the Serbs' desire to continue working politically while under indictment in The Hague. Ceku has not been... There's an Interpol... Well, no, the Serbs have an arrest warrant out for Ceku, but the international community doesn't, and the Hague doesn't. Now, it's a complicated story, this. The reason why Ceku is a significant figure for the Serbs is he also fought in the Croatian War as well as the Kosovo on behalf on the side of the Croats. You're right, essentially, in terms of perception, the Serbs do feel that this is weighted against them, and there have been some rather inelegant moves by the international community which would appear to confirm their perception. But at the same time, it is terribly important at the moment that for Serbia, as much as for the Albanians in Kosovo, that over the next year we overcome the final hurdle towards a sort of lasting peace process in southeastern Europe, which is the issue of Kosovo. And as it happens, you have to have an element of pragmatism in this, rather like as in Northern Ireland, where you amnesty certain people because they are the only people who can fix the peace process for you. That was the case with both Republicans and with Unionists in Northern Ireland. So you have to be flexible with people like Ceku. Now, Ceku, as I say, hasn't been indicted anywhere else. And as it happens, he is politically one of the most sane, and there aren't very many of them, operators in Kosovo at the moment, and he will be a useful partner for the Serbs to have in dialogue. But this is political pragmatism. It is not political principles that I'm talking about. As regards Camp Bondsteel, well, first of all, they never do anything in Camp Bondsteel. They're too frightened to go outside. And it's this huge, it's rather like, you know, a sort of Champaign-Urbana, but without the university. You know, there are sort of KFCs and Walgreens and this sort of thing. And they all just hang around there being American. They don't actually do anything. And as a lily pad, it's a very inconvenient lily pad. What the Americans have been doing, which is much more significant, is negotiating the use of air and naval facilities in Romania and Bulgaria, which is nearer the zone of operations that interests them. And Kosovo is actually a very inconvenient place logistically. The reason why the United States is so keen at the moment to get the Kosovo thing sorted out and a solution found within the years, because they want to dismantle Bondsteel and get the hell out of Kosovo, because it's not an effective lily pad.
I think that, I don't know, I don't know that I accept that. Chalmers Johnson actually talks about it in Sorrows of Empire at some length, and I think regionally, particularly with the way Turkey was going some time ago with the opposition to the Iraq War, the idea was that those bases could possibly somewhat be in jeopardy, actually.
Well, yeah, it's absolutely possible. All I'm saying, I'm not saying that the lily pad theory doesn't exist and that there's real evidence to support it. What I'm saying is that Bondsteel doesn't actually fit into it, and the Americans have been gagging. I mean, you know, State Defense and the White House have been gagging for a long time to dismantle Bondsteel and get out, because it doesn't fit into it's you know, geographically, it doesn't fit into their pattern. It's a little too far away, which is why they've spent a lot of time and energy successfully negotiating the construction of bases in Romania and Bulgaria, which are nearer the zone of operations where they need them. If you see what I mean.
They're not sure where they're going to need them, actually, the way things are going. I suppose you could just argue that it was just another lucrative Brown and Root contract, I suppose.
Yeah, you could argue that as well.
Back to Ketu, you know, one of the problems with charging him on the level was because the Krajina dispersion of or ethnic cleansing of the Serbs from Croatia was partially negotiated by in Dayton, if my recollection is correct, and so he was.
No, your recollection is incorrect. The cleansing had happened by the time of Dayton. It was in the summer of 1995.
Okay, well, but
unquestionably a tacit approval by the Americans to let that happen.
Okay, well, actually there were some dealings with the Central Command, our supreme commander, whose name is escaping me for some reason right now. They called him the Supreme Being as a joke, I guess. His fellow officers did, you know, ran for Democratic presidency. I don't know why I can't remember his name. But I mean, part of what, since there was this tacit approval for all of that activity, that's the kind of stuff that becomes somewhat embarrassing if it goes to court, and he could actually bring that kind of thing up. Comparably, you know, we have the situation in Iraq. Now, if this guy Taylor in Liberia can be accused for helping participate in arming the Sierra Leonean fighters, then, you know, why can't Rumsfeld be put in the docket for aiding the Iraqis when they attacked Iran? So Victor's justice is, I'm afraid, ubiquitous. I'll ring off. Thanks.
All right. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. I'd like to introduce again the guest for this hour, talking with journalist Misha Glenny. During the Yugoslav crisis of the early 90s, he was Central Europe correspondent for the BBC World Service. He's authored two books, the first, The Fall of Yugoslavia, published in 1992, and then The Balkans, published in 1999. And right now, he's working on a reporting project, that no doubt will end up as a book, looking at organized crime in the global economy, and it's some of its connections, in fact, to the conflict that we have here been talking about. And that will be the subject of a speech he'll be giving. This is in the Millercom series. The title is The Spider Trap: Corruption, Organized Crime, and Transition in the Balkans and Russia. That's tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. Anyone interested in attending can stop by. Also here on the program, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to take a big step back, you talked a little bit earlier about how Yugoslavia here was, it was a country made up of these somewhat disparate pieces. Some people, I suppose, could have made the argument that it should never have been a country in the first place. But here it was, and it was held together by Tito, backed up by Russia, by the Soviet Union. And when the Soviet Union started to come apart, then the disparate parts in Yugoslavia started thinking about, well, we're going to go, you know, whichever way we want. It was the Serbs that sort of identified with Russia, and Milosevic trying to put together his biggest state that he could. Slovenia and Croatia lean the other way. They were interested in affiliating with Europe. They wanted out of there. I guess some people ask this question, well, if the major powers of Europe, the Germans particularly, the French maybe, the British, had gone to the Slovenians and the Croatians and said, look, we can work on this project, and there could be even the possibility of you guys eventually becoming members of the EU. But right for the moment, let's go slow. Let's take it easy here, because there's the possibility for huge conflict here if things get out of hand. Now, maybe this is hindsight, you know, but I think that some people did indeed fault, particularly the Germans, for essentially giving the Croatians and the Slovenians the signal that says, fine, you go do what you want. We'll back you. Could, if we go back to that point, if things had gone differently, could we have avoided what happened?
Well, I always think there are possible to it's possible to avoid things like this. And, I mean, you answered your own question there, because the European Union didn't, as a coherent body, go to the Croats and Slovenes and say that, because that's what the British and the French were saying, and the Germans were saying something else. And as soon as you have disunity in an international forum, then the players on the ground are going to exploit that disunity. One tiny correction about what you said is that Yugoslavia, Tito's Yugoslavia, was not backed by the Soviet Union. It straddled east and west, and it cultivated good relations with both. Now, Yugoslavia under Tito was a remarkable place. The Yugoslav passport was the best passport to have in the whole of Europe. You could travel all over Eastern Europe without visas, and all over Western Europe without visas. And it was a relatively liberal society as a communist society. A lot of people from the West went on holiday there, and people went to Western Europe to work as immigrant workers, as guest workers, as they were called. And it was a very, very cosmopolitan place. There were very good things about Yugoslavia. You know, before the war started, on a parochial level, a lot of Serbs and Croats and Bosniaks and Albanians got on fine together. There wasn't these immense problems that emerged in the 1990s. And so, yes, politically, it could have been avoided. But the local actors, Milosevic and Tudjman in particular, were courting their international sponsors, in particularly Germany and Russia in the first instance, and exploiting the fact that there was no unity, or indeed in some cases interest, in the international community about what was going on there. So, but it could have been a very different story, in my opinion.
Yeah. I want to have you talk a little bit about one of the other of the former Yugoslav republics, and that's Macedonia.
Oh.
Because here, this is a place actually that some people point to and say, now here is actually a success story, because here we have a place where there had been potential for conflict. There's a significant Albanian minority there. And in fact, at one point, there were the last ones who were hanging with the Serbs. For a while, Serbia and Macedonia were still calling themselves Yugoslavia.
No, that was Serbia and Montenegro.
Oh, it's too complicated.
But let's take Macedonia.
The other part, I think I got that right. that here is a place where things could have gone very, very wrong, and in fact, things have gone pretty well.
They almost did go very, very wrong. A few years ago, it was on the brink of civil war, and they pulled back at the very edge. I mean, they had started fighting. The European Union came in, gave it some real incentives for this not to happen, both carrots and sticks, and they came up with something called the Ohrid Agreement, which is what Macedonia is now based upon, which gives the Albanians a much bigger say in the state and how it's run. And as a consequence of this, they have got much closer, because of the fact that they behaved very well and they tried very hard, both sides, to, you know, keep their noses out of things while this was going on. They are now further along the process of European Union integration than Serbia, Bosnia, and certainly Kosovo and Albania. Now, this is something that is peculiar about the solution of the conflict in the former Yugoslavia, is that all these countries are eligible to apply and to be considered, and the EU has made a commitment eventually to absorb all of them into its ranks. And the European Union, with all its money and affluence and trade access and free movement of people around the European Union, is a tremendously powerful magnet which persuades people to lay down their arms, to stop conflict, and instead to get a fast track to prosperity, which is what the EU offers. Now, in the former Yugoslavia, we can do that because it's part of Europe and it's been given a promise. Elsewhere, it's much more difficult to provide incentives of that magnitude to persuade people to put down their arms. So it's a very, very important thing. And Macedonia is a classic case where they were on the verge of war, and the power of the possibility of EU membership basically persuaded them not to go over the precipice. It was a very, very important lesson, in my opinion.
Well, let's then come back to Kosovo. What here this, we have totally unresolved conflict here, great, again, potential violence again. We have peacekeepers there that have been keeping things calm for...
Ish.
Yeah. I think the real suspicion that if they should leave, fighting would... the Serbs, it seems still we have this... The Albanian Kosovars would like to be independent. Serbia, I think, still is not keen on that idea. This seems like there's no place to go.
Right. Here. Okay, we reel back a little bit. 1999, NATO goes to war with Serbia on behalf of the Kosovo Albanians. NATO wins that war, but as seems to be developing into a habit with these military interventions, it didn't really have a plan about what it was going to do once it had won the war, and it left the situation of Kosovo constitutionally ambiguous. Kosovo was still part of Serbia, but it was under temporary protection, as it were. It is a protectorate of the international community, and it was handed over to the United Nations. Now, the UN basically is a whipping boy in this, because the UN does not have the capacity to run a complex country like Kosovo. And under the UN's stewardship, despite all their best efforts, the economy, above all else, of Kosovo went down and down and down and down. Privatization was an absolute mess, and unemployment rates among youth Albanians in Kosovo now run at about 70%. This is very, very dangerous. The UN has presided over the only territory in Europe which records now negative growth every year economically. This is very dangerous, and it has to be, this UN protectorate business has to come to an end. Now, the international community, including Russia, supposed backers and sponsors of the Serbs, have got together and said, right, we've now got to have a process and we've got to move towards constitutional clarity. Will it be independent? Will it be part of Serbia? They have, although they consistently deny this in public, agreed amongst themselves, including Russia, that Kosovo is going to be independent. And the process is, how do we make it independent? There are two big issues here. First of all, how do you get Albanians to treat their Serbian minority properly? And that's a very, very difficult issue, because you can't give independence to a country and then watch them treat their, you know, main minority like dirt. It's just, it looks bad. It's unprincipled. Secondly, how do you persuade the Serbs to accept Kosovo as independent? Because if you don't get Serbia to agree to this process of independence, then... You've got a problem long term, because they will insist on a claim on that territory, and Kosovo cannot defend itself against Serbia independently, and so that means you can't get rid of the troops. And the whole point about this constitutional process, or one of the points, is to get rid of the troops. So you have to think of ways of giving Serbia an incentive. Now, at the moment, all the Serbian leaders are saying, we will let Kosovo become independent over our dead bodies. Mm-hmm. In private, however, just as the international community know that they're pushing for independence, the leadership of Serbia understands that independence is coming and there's nothing that they can do about it. So what they're looking for is incentives. If you go to the electorate, as they'll have to do fairly soon, and say, you know, we've lost Kosovo, we've lost other territories, that's our electoral program, you're going to lose. And the guys who are in at the moment are more or less the good guys. The guys who are not in, but who could come in at the next Serbian election, are basically the bad guys. So you have to give something to Serbia which persuades the people of Serbia that giving up Kosovo, which they understand instinctively that it is lost already, you've got to give them something in return, because otherwise they're just not going to accept it, and I don't see why they should.
Is Kosovo viable as an independent country?
Well, that's a very good question. Frankly, I doubt it. I mean, it's a very chaotic place. It's an economic disaster area, and it is one of the main focuses of organized crime, and particularly heroin trafficking into the European Union, and that's not going to change in a hurry. And, you know, the Kosovo Albanians have very little experience of running a state properly. It hasn't been helped by the fact that the UN has been doing it and has been reluctant to allow them to create their own state. So it's going to be very, very difficult, and it's going to take them a long time before they reach the standards that will be required to be serious candidates for the European Union. And this key issue about the Serbian minority is absolutely key. You know, the Albanians of Kosovo have to understand that if they want to turn Kosovo into a viable state, it's no good just giving lip service to minority rights. They have to defend Serbs. They have to make sure that Serbs have access to all goods, to all services in the state, and to economic prosperity and so on and so forth. And they have to make a real effort. And frankly, up until now, they haven't.
Hmm. Is there an Albanian interest, given the fact that the majority of the Kosovo people are ethnically Albanian? Now, I don't know if there are people in Albania who say, well, really, this should be part of Albania.
Well, there are people who say that in Albania, but there aren't very many. On a popular level, well, there is sort of, you know, general support for Kosovo independence as a principle in Albania proper. They have been separated for a very long time, and the popular view of Kosovo in Albania proper is that they're all crooks and thieves and violent mountain people, and they don't want anything to do with them. But that is the popular view. It is, of course, a political issue that is used as an instrument within Albanian politics. But any independence of Kosovo that was sanctioned by the international community would include a cast iron insistence that those borders are not tampered with, and unification with Albania or with the Albanian part of Macedonia is absolutely out of the question, and that it will become isolated. All countries involved will become isolated in the event that that happens. So I don't think that I don't think it's likely. But it's a fear that a lot of people in the Balkans have, that an independent Kosovo may stir up a greater Albanian nationalism and create a new round of conflict.
We've got about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with journalist Misha Glenny. Back in the early 90s, during the Yugoslav crisis, he was Central Europe correspondent for the BBC World Service, has written two books about the region, and is here visiting to talk tonight on the U of I campus. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'd like to, maybe as a last thing, we could talk a little bit about, have you talk about Bosnia. And here, there was another major conflict. This was the one that really got people's attention, if the Croatian War didn't, when Croatia and Serbia decided, well, we might as well have some pieces of this too. And the Serbs working through their kind of proxies, Serbs in Bosnia, guys like General Mladic and Radovan Karadzic, who are still on the most wanted list as far as the Hague is concerned, carried out ethnic cleansing there. I guess the question is, you know, I think some people after the conflict said there should be some sort of a possibility to again build a stable kind of multi-ethnic peaceful society there. How has that been a success?
Well, first of all, it's a similar situation to Kosovo in as much that it is a protectorate, a quasi-protectorate, a mandate, if you like, run by a series of European politicians known as the High Representative and latterly the European Union Representative. And so it's pretty difficult for them to develop a politics of their own, and that hasn't happened. It's very corrupt. Economically, its prospects are very poor. However, despite that, let us mention the very good things about Bosnia-Herzegovina, of which there are some. Above all else, the program of returns, of refugee returns, has been immensely successful. A lot of people have returned to the homes where they were cleansed from, into areas which are still under control of the nationality that cleansed them in the first place. So you have a lot of Muslims returning to the part of Bosnia which is run largely by Serbian parties called the Republika Srpska. And you have a lot of Serbs returning to areas under Croat and Muslim control, Croat control in particular, from where they were cleansed. And this has been a tremendous success, and you have seen the nerve endings between the communities which were severed by the war starting to grow slowly back together again. And this is a very sort of, you know, inspiriting process to observe. There are, however, immense problems, not the least of which is the issue of Radovan Karadzic, who's holed up somewhere in Republika Srpska and, is basically sustained by a huge and very rich criminal network there. And they're unwilling to give him up because it's a very happy bargaining chip for them, and I'm sure they believe in his goodness and so on and so forth. But this makes it very difficult for Bosnia to progress. Karadzic is holding hostage Bosnia's progress vis-à-vis the European Union as a consequence. I don't think that if Karadzic and Mladic were turned over, there's going to be rioting in the street at all. I mean, I think that most Serbs, particularly in Serbia itself, view them the way that they viewed Milosevic, as this is a man, these are men who contributed to turning their country into a complete pariah state, who lost four wars, and who have brought them nothing but immiseration and scorn. And I don't think anyone's going to be too sad to see them go. But as long as he's being protected and as long as Mladic is being protected, it is a real problem in terms of making progress.
Well, that seems to be something that the Europeans didn't want to push because they weren't willing to spill a lot of blood rounding these guys up.
Well, it was actually the United States who were responsible for Mladic initially. They controlled the area that Mladic was in and they refused to go in and take him because they were worried. The French then took over large parts of the area, and the French did the same thing. Mm. So we have to share responsibility for this.
Let's be fair. Is this something that you think the Serbs, that Serbia can actually help with and might be inclined, and again, as a way of trying to, you know, build bridges between themselves and the Europeans, that they might actually be able to?
Well, I certainly hope so. I do know that the Serbian Prime Minister, Vojislav Koštunica, really does want to capture Mladic. That's the onus on Serbia because Mladic is in Serbia. If he could, he would. Mladic is protected by Serbian military intelligence, and that's no mean operation. Both Koštunica, the Prime Minister, and Boris Tadic, the President, really do want to get Mladic and get him to The Hague. It's a difficult thing for them to do, and they would prefer him to go voluntarily. This is one of the problems of the Milosevic death, is that after Milosevic's death, and that came a week after the death of another Serb in custody in The Hague who committed suicide, Mladic, who is not a man of sound mind in any respect, will be easily convinced that if he were to give himself up voluntarily, then, you know, it won't be long before he's killed in The Hague. I'm sure that's what he thinks and what people will be telling him. So they're going to have to grab Mladic, and that means they may have to, you know, they run the risk of spilling some blood of their operatives, but you won't see the masses come out onto the streets in support of Ratko Mladic if he's handed over to The Hague.
We're just about at the point that we have used our time. Is it possible to say that one is generally optimistic about the potential for this region now and in the future?
One step forward, two steps sideways is how I would put it. And but yes, we have two big hurdles left. One is Mladic and Karadzic. The other, and this is the real challenge, is Kosovo over the next year. If those challenges were resolved positively, and there's, you know, there's a real prospect that they will be, then I think you will see southeastern Europe, the Balkans, close the 20th century and move forward into a much more prosperous 21st century. But it isn't over till the fat lady sings, basically, and she hasn't yet.
Our guest, Misha Glenny, he covered Central Europe for the BBC in the early 90s. He covered the Yugoslav crisis. He's written two books, The Fall of Yugoslavia and the Balkans. He is here to give a talk. This is in the Millercom series, The Spider Trap, Corruption, Organized Crime, and Transition in the Balkans and Russia, tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. Anyone invited. And one of these days that will be a book, and maybe we can talk about it.
It will, very soon, and yes, we will.
All right.
That'd be great.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The broadcast today made possible with support from Prairie Land Community Supported Agriculture, proud to support informational programming on WILO. Prairie Land CSA links consumers wanting local pesticide-free produce directly with the farmers who grow it on the web at prairielandcsa.org. Programming here also made possible by the Krennert Center for the Performing Arts, featuring performances by the gifted jazz saxophonist Joshua Redman and his quartet, and the reggae-funk Afro-Cuban mix of the Chicago-based band Funkadaisy. Visit krennertcenter.com for more information. A little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, in their 1 o'clock hour, the subject will be poetry. And Celeste Quinn will be talking with Ed Hirsch. He says that poetry is intimate and secretive, yet generously collective. He says poems offer us a way of being simultaneously alone and together through art. A conversation with the poet coming up on the Afternoon Magazine today. He's the author of 11 books, including Poet's Choice and How to Read a Poem. He'll be with Celeste following the 1 o'clock news. The show itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580 with the usual mix of news and sports and weather. In the next part of this show, we'll be talking with theologian and ethicist Stanley Hauerwas. He's professor of theological ethics at the Duke University Divinity School, longtime a promoter of nonviolence and known as one of the best-known defenders of Christian pacifism today. He'll be with us in the next part of the show. First, though, we'll take a break. We'll have an update on the markets and the news, so stay tuned.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri-Energy in Palestine, Illinois, producing a renewable fuel.